Hello guys again, here is Jan connecting with you from Southeast Europe, and I have Dan aka Queenlock coming from Prague, am I right?
Yes, you're right. Hello and welcome.
And we have with us Ambassador Cameron Munter, former US ambassador to Pakistan. He also served as a chief of reconstruction team in northern Iraq. He served at National Security Council. He has many hats. He also used to be ambassador to Serbia. He used to teach at university in New York. So he is our, let's say, Middle Eastern hand to talk with us what happened to U.S. Middle Eastern policy, you know, last few years when there were mistakes, and what will United States probably do now. Hello, it's great to having you, Ambassador.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Jan. Thank you.
So let me start with Jake Sullivan, your current or Mr. President Biden's current national security advisor. He wrote a huge piece. I think it's more than 10 pages, maybe even longer, in Foreign Affairs magazine. It was written and printed just before deadly 7th of October. And it's very positive. Middle East is most quiet in a decade. Nothing is happening. Hamas is calm. Future is bright and rosy. Why, Ambassador, you think this disconnection from reality? What Washington and State Department did wrong?
Well, thanks so much, Jan, for the opportunity. And let's be fair to Jake. He did not say everything is rosy. He said challenges exist. But he did allow what I think is his mental construct of global policy to dominate his understanding of the local situation in the Middle East. That is to say, what the Biden administration has tried to do since it came into power is to focus on what it calls the biggest priority. The biggest priority is China. And so when you read this article, what you read is, yes, it was terrible what happened in Afghanistan, but we are glad that we aren't in Afghanistan anymore. We have worked with our friends, our alliances to keep the Russians at bay, but we're always focusing on the main issue, which is China. The problem that I think you accurately point out is the world doesn't always work that way. That is to say, you can have a priority, but the world may have other priorities. And this is, I think, something that is an intellectual problem that Jake, who is a very, very smart guy, and the administration have, which is they kind of expected that what would happen is they would focus on China and somehow the world would allow them to do that. Others took advantage of this. Hamas took advantage, I think, of what it was perceived as American inattention. But Hamas also took advantage of the fact that America's perceived success, and don't forget, Jake Sullivan talked about this, the success of the so-called Abraham Accords and the idea that Israel would open up relationships with Saudi Arabia got in the way of what Hamas had in mind of keeping the Arab world and generally the global South focused on the plight of Palestinians. So in a way, moving ahead with slow progress, trying to keep Iran in a box, keep the Saudis working with the Israelis, keep the Gulf states working. That was not just something that was good for the United States. That was a threat to Hamas. Hamas responded, and the Americans were surprised.
When Benjamin Netanyahu talked about a new peace, a new era of peace and prosperity in the Middle East 1.5 months ago, do you think it was based on a real fundament or not?
I think it was certainly based on what he believed to be the truth. I think what he thought was, we have outflanked the Palestinians. I think, again, I'm speaking for someone I don't know, but I think he believed that by working with the Saudis, by working with the Gulf states, by also taking into account that the Chinese, through clever diplomacy, have actually defused some of the Iranian-Saudi tensions, I think what he thought was, we have taken the focus of the Arab world, of the Islamic world, away from the plight of the people in Palestine, and we have moved it towards global politics. Guess what? The people in Palestine didn't like that.
Back to Washington. Mm-hmm. Okay, the administration is here with us for quite some time. Trump and Jared Kushner are not there for 3 years. So what's at the end current administration's strategic objectives in the Middle East? I understand everything is in the Pacific these days, but you know, pre 7 October, what do you think that was the administration's thinking, and how does it evolve now?
It's not popular for the Democrats to say anything nice about Trump. But in fact, if you look at what the Democrats did, they very quietly, we would say, pocketed. They very quietly accepted what the Trump administration had done with the Abraham Accords and continued it. So there was a continuation of Republican policy, which was to try to make peace between Israel and its not immediate neighbors, but its broader neighbors, the Saudis, et cetera, and to accept that as a new reality. I think that's what Netanyahu believed. I think that's how Netanyahu believed he would contain what he sees as the existential threat to Israel, which is Iran. And I think what everyone neglected, because they simply wanted to believe, is that this new reality of Israel, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, would become simply the way politics worked. And they guessed wrong.
When, for example, Donald Trump came back and became again a U.S. president, what would expect from him?
Well, let's not forget that Donald Trump is not a strategic thinker. Donald Trump is an opportunist, and he will take this is both good and bad. He will take advantage of a situation that he sees as different, and he may upset the American foreign policy establishment by saying, let's try something different. Let's try something new. He could be quite supportive of Netanyahu. Here, Biden is trying to respond to what he sees as a humanitarian crisis with 10,000 Palestinians allegedly killed in Gaza, working with the G7 to say we should have a humanitarian pause or something like this. This may not be what Donald Trump says. He might just give a blank check to Netanyahu. He might say, this is the way we have to deal with these guys. We simply don't know. So my answer to your question is not that I can give a real prediction, but I can predict based on the kind of personality Donald Trump is, he will be opportunistic and he will try to take advantage of a new and changed situation.
Currently, we have two carrier strike groups in Eastern Mediterranean. So plenty of muscle from United States in the region. What do you think? We see, you know, rhetorics of Biden. That's one thing, but you know, people can say one thing and do something different. So what do you think that is really in the minds of Washington and how they are moving forward now with their Middle Eastern strategy now post 7 October?
It's hard to say. This is really something where there is both what Biden wants and what our military is expecting. And these are not necessarily always the same things. But you have an analogy of 1973. In 1973, when the Seven-Day War took place, the Americans put their forces on very high alert. And in the understanding that's come down through analysts over the years, that high alert deterred, according to them, the Soviets from acting, taking advantage of this crisis to do something else. I think that part of what they are doing is giving a signal to Iran, to Hezbollah, to other countries in the region that might wish to take advantage of the problems there, not to spread the war. Because the Americans are not only dealing with the immediate issues that what Tony Blinken is talking about as he shuttles back and forth between Amman and Cairo and everywhere else, the immediate issues of what's happening in Gaza. There is enormous concern that the war would spread. That's where I think the fleet comes in. The idea of the fleet is at least intended, based on the model of 1973, to deter anyone in the region from making this worse than it actually is.
Maybe I would stop just for some short time at Hamas attack on Israel. There are some talks that Israel makes a huge mistake when it wants to win by force. And there are some talks that political solution is possible or better even because Israel is threatened to lose its partners. So what's your opinion on this solution?
it's hard to see a political solution in my mind. A political solution depends on the idea that both sides are able to make some sort of agreement. And at this point, I simply don't see it. That is to say, Dan Kurtzer, former U.S. ambassador to Israel, wrote in The Atlantic either today or yesterday that the idea of a pause, the idea of a humanitarian pause or even a ceasefire, when you really take it apart, when you really look at it, there's no way to implement this in the way that a normal pause or ceasefire might be implemented. There is no way to do this. The only thing that Israel can do is to destroy Hamas. And if Israel is destroying Hamas, all of these other issues that have to do with humanitarian suffering or with other broader questions about a political solution fall by the wayside. So as long as Israel is committed to doing what it clearly is committed to doing, which is destroying Hamas, I don't see any notion that there can be a pause or a political solution. Now, there's a second question you've asked, which is, can it work? Can they do it? My experience in northern Iraq was, be very careful about trying to solve a problem of this sort over the long term, strictly political, by military means. You know, you have the model of what happened to ISIS in Mosul. You have the other models of what happened in that war, but it is very, very difficult. And I think the American military, strictly the military, has been advising the Israelis be very careful about expecting to wipe out, it's not a state, it's a movement, to wipe out a movement. And indeed, to come up with a solution that actually can do something about the underlying problems that led to that movement in the first place. So I think we are in for some very, very difficult days without a political solution, without a humanitarian pause, where the Israelis move ahead, and they will not stop, in my opinion.
I think that there is another similarity between Gaza. You mentioned already Mosul, your experience, but you also were American ambassador to Pakistan. So basically, next to Pakistan, we got a territory similar to Mosul or similar to Gaza that used to be run by movement, Taliban, and Mujahideens. American force, American might came in militarily. Everything looked great, but then political solution didn't work. And at the end, as we saw several years ago, not even years, a year and a half, Afghanistan was left behind. So do you see, based on your Pakistan / Afghanistan experience, some, I would say, answers to avoid mistakes? If you would now be sitting, you know, next to Bibi Netanyahu, what would be your advice, Benio, based on experience?
Well, the experience, the advice that our military people gave to Netanyahu, and we have given a great deal of it, military advice, is do not expect that by doing what you set out to do, which is to decapitate, to destroy the infrastructure of Hamas, to decapitate the leadership and all this, do not think that that is going to give you the end result solution. What I think the Israelis are probably saying to themselves is, no, there are two parts to this, and you Americans are mixing the two parts. One is, we have to wipe these people out, period. That's what they want. At that time, then they will try to figure out what are the ways in which a political solution is possible. The debate has come up, can Israel stay in Gaza? Israel says, we won't stay in Gaza. And yet you hear Netanyahu saying, we will stay indefinitely, until at which time we can come up with a political solution. So my only way of making sense of this is, they are going to go ahead and do a military solution to an immediate problem, and then they are going to address the political question. People in the West are thinking of both of them at the same time, but the Israelis will do it, I'm convinced, sequentially.
We didn't mention yet the increasing role of China, not only in this region. Shall we be afraid of it?
I don't think so. I think actually it's this may sound counterfactual to you, but I think it's actually an opportunity. Xi Jinping has agreed that he will meet with Joe Biden in San Francisco later this month, or at least in the coming weeks. And I think this may be one of the areas in which they may find common ground. We tend to think, or at least the press often talks about Chinese malign kind of stirring the pot, making problems. My interpretation of Chinese policy is that it is not simply troublemaking. It is very strategic, and it does not generally like uncontrolled violence. I think that stability, in a certain sense, it may not be the stability that other people want. Stability is what Chinese leadership is looking for. So I would actually predict that there is a possibility of America and China finding some, maybe, I don't know how much, common ground in coming weeks, and that that may be part of the second stage I was talking about, the discussion about a political solution.
Maybe one additional question only, Honzo. There was a change in the post of Chinese Ministry of Foreign Relations. Wang Yi is back. Hasn't changed anything in the foreign relations, because Wang Yi is a proponent of wolf warrior diplomacy, and Xinjiang was more open to discuss.
I think Wang is an expert who has been at his post for a very long time. That is to say, this is not a new face. This is someone who is very well acquainted with the long-term discussions and the developments of Chinese policy. So while you might have had in the new foreign minister who now deposed some new ideas, I don't think you're going to come up with things that are surprises from the current leadership. I think what you can look for among the Chinese leadership now is an attempt to be steady, attempt to be predictable, and an attempt to try to figure out very carefully how to take advantage of what has happened in the Middle East. But I do not see them being reckless at all.
You know, it's not isolated conflict. Gaza cannot be ring-fenced. You know, Queen Olog just talked about China with you. There are also Arab capitals.
Yes.
There is General Sisi in Cairo. There is King in Amman. There's Saudis. Lebanon, unfortunately, almost failed state. What's your analysis of, you know, their rhetorics and what they are really doing? You know, what's their strategy for future? You know, is everything lost? Abraham Accords, and now the streets in the capitals will lead the way? Or, you know, how you analyze it?
Well, this is my greatest fear, which is that there are the unforeseen impacts of what's happening in Gaza that will have an impact on very unstable people in the region. Let's take two countries that you mentioned, Lebanon and Egypt. In Egypt, look at what you have on your borders. You have Libya, which is a mess. You have Sudan. You have Ethiopia, where terrible things have been happening over the last couple of years. You have Yemen, which is barely under control. And now you have Gaza and people pressing you to take for your country for humanitarian reasons, the people who are maybe suffering in Gaza. And of course, the Egyptians, even if they wanted to, they're hardly able to do a very good job of this. If I am sitting in Cairo, I'm going to feel besieged on all sides, and I'm going to worry about people taking advantage of the unstable situation from all directions, not just from Gaza, right? So the stability of Egypt is something to really watch. Second example, of course, is everyone has been waiting in Lebanon for the question of what will Hezbollah do. And Hezbollah, as the proxy of Iran, you know, can make things tougher for the Israelis, open a second front or not. What does that do to Lebanon and the Lebanese army, which is generally considered a force for stability? But is it capable of remaining a force for stability? And so that the two countries themselves, I would imagine, again, I don't know, but I would imagine that they had hoped and counted on the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia working out ways to work with Israel to make their economic and social problems less pressing. That is to say, I think I have to guess that the leadership in Lebanon and Egypt had big hopes for what the Abraham Accords and the additional agreements might bring. They must be now, I would have to imagine, simply in reactive mode, hoping that things don't get out of control. And in both countries, there's a real danger of it.
You've touched on a very important question. I mean, Arabian countries mostly express their support for Palestinian people, but they don't want to accept any migrants from Gaza. How shall we understand that?
Well, I think part of it is that they have always wanted to keep the problem at arm's length. And this was, I think, part of what allowed the Abraham Accords actually to go forward. That is, for years and years, there had been the empty phrases that many Arab leaders had used in support of Palestine. You know, in the country where I was ambassador, Pakistan, there are people all over the streets, even today, demonstrating on behalf of Palestine. Well, it's easy when it's thousands of miles away. It was a certain amount of virtue signaling going on. But now you have a difficulty. If you were to actually take massive number of refugees away from Gaza, what you are essentially saying is we are changing the way things have been. We're going to actually redraw the map of the problems in the Middle East. And this terrifies these countries who are surprised by what's happened. But if you had millions of people leaving Gaza, you would be adding to the load that all of these unstable countries have. And I think you can call them hypocrites if you want, but you can also just call them realists. They just don't think they're in a position to handle the overwhelming change that would mean for the entire region.
Maybe additional question that is connected with it. Is it based on experience, for example, from Lebanon, just from Lebanon, that accepted a lot of refugees from Syria? Is it similar?
Well, Lebanon was overwhelmed. I think, again, I don't know, have my numbers straight, but, you know, just there's a couple million people who live in Lebanon, and there were a couple of million refugees who were living in Lebanon coming from Syria, et cetera. This put an enormous strain. We don't tend to give credit when we talk about, not credit, but, you know, to explain the financial meltdown that took place in Lebanon. People say, oh, it was corruption or it was, you know, other kinds of problems. But the strain that the refugees put on the Lebanese economy was enormous. And the impact that had on the confidence of investors and other people in the region was enormous. So I guess if I understand your question correctly, yes, I agree that the historical lesson of what happened to Lebanon in the wake of the Syrian war is something that other countries who might accept refugees are looking at very closely.
Another large country that is sort of like, you know, like Geno's head, you know, with West against West, sometimes Israel, but not so much, it's Turkey. Mm-hmm. There is a personality of Erdogan, his past. He is pious Muslim. He was and is close to Muslim Brotherhoods. Turkey tried to have more détente with Israel, you know, 3-4 years ago. They started to have diplomatic relations. There were visits. President Herzog visited Ankara. Now it's gone. And we see demonstrations in Ankara, Istanbul, and elsewhere. And we see very hard language coming from Ankara. So what's your takeaway, and what's this game is all about?
I don't disagree with you that I think Erdogan is a pious Muslim and that he has based his attractiveness in his longevity as a leader on portraying himself as an active defender of Islam and of the oppressed in Islam. That said, my feeling is that Erdogan is primarily a real politician. That is to say, what he will do is what's best for him in keeping his domestic power. And if it means that he will sell out the Palestinians, he will sell out the Palestinians. If it means that he will sell out the Israelis, he will sell out the Israelis. What he wants to do is make sure that he stays in power and that his, let's call it, neo-Ottoman designs can be realized. So I would not go too far in looking at him as motivated by pity or by solidarity. I would see him as motivated by power, which he's very good at, and he will simply calculate what he can do to appear to be the most powerful man in the neighborhood and how this can work to his advantage.
So basically, he's trying to copycat his approach towards Russia, Ukraine.
Absolutely. And if there are people protesting, and if he sees that there are his people, that is to say, the so-called, you know, the old Black Turk, White Turk problem, you know, that they are the common people in Turkey and they're upset, he will follow what they say. And at the end of the day, though, what he will try to do is, having fortified his position at home, he will try to say, in this very unsettled situation, can I take advantage of it? Is there something that has to do with Palestine, with Iran, with Russia, with Central Asia that is useful for me? That's what he will do, in my opinion.
We talked about Turkey, about Saudi Arabia as two key players in this region. The third key player is Iran, we have already talked about. But I would like to know, the regime in Iran seems to be not in a good shape, I suppose. There's a lot of social unrest. Should we await anything big there in this country?
Well, I really don't know how the situation is domestically. It's been my impression that since the large demonstrations of a year ago, things have quieted down and the security forces have established order, but they haven't solved the problems and the anger that many of the people in the country have towards the regime. That said, I think that Iran could see itself as the big winner here, because it was in a position where a couple of, shall we say, developments would lead to it being pushed backwards, especially, of course, the Saudi Israeli agreement and warming that has been put to an end by what happened in Gaza. So I don't expect that the foreign policy issues or the foreign policy decisions of Iran could lead. It would surprise me if that led to domestic unrest. That wouldn't be the cause in my mind. There are domestic reasons for domestic unrest. But I can see the Iranians feeling right now that there are things that are going their way, and that the more unsettled things are, the less likely they are to be cornered.
Maybe additional, Honzo, on an additional question, you touched the Israeli and Saudi Arabia relations. Could we expect that the negotiations, a peace treaty, could be ongoing, for example, in 1 or 2 years?
Oh, I think things could change radically. It's very, very hard to look beyond even tomorrow here. I don't exclude the fact that the relationships that the Israelis and the Saudis have is built on much more than just a couple of leaders. You mentioned, you know, whether Kushner or Trump, you know, pulled a fast one and made a deal. There have been strong ties between the Israelis in the business community and in other areas, between the Israelis and the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia for many years. This has been going on quietly for quite a while. You could not have had those agreements if you hadn't set the stage by having financial, tech, and other elements that had been developing for many, many years. Those relationships, I would assume, are not going to go away. Now, whether or not they will lead to a reopening of the possibilities of Saudi Israeli rapprochement, a lot of that will depend on what happens in Gaza, and whether or not the Saudis, you know, are no friends of Hamas, and the way that the Israelis deal with Hamas, how they deal with Hamas, how they deal with this militarily, how they then turn to a political solution. We don't know any of that yet, or I certainly don't have a clue. And once that happens, the Saudis will try to figure out, well, maybe those things that we have built upon, the foundation that we've built, can be built again.
Gaza is not the only conflict in Middle East. The 500,000 dead in Syria, 150,000 dead in Yemen. As you said, Algeria's mess, problems in Sudan, African Horn. Previously, for decades, America was a Middle Eastern policeman. Now, Russia tried to fill the void in the case of Syria. China is coming a little bit close as well. So who you think will be policing Middle East in the future? And is it possible that it's going to be Arabs themselves?
Certainly, that's what Jake Sullivan would like, it seems. But I take issue a little bit with America the Policeman, which is something that, you know, a lot of people talk about. America, even in its unipolar moment, was not able to dictate or situation in the Middle East, nor was it able to prevent violence and anti-American feeling. I think there is a tendency, I don't mean to be too unfair, but let's try to say this. There's a tendency to see that America was all powerful in the past, and therefore to look around, say, oh, America, whether you're blaming Obama for the red line in Syria or Biden for the Jake Sullivan speech, that all of a sudden America is weak and flat on its back. I think neither of these things is true. Neither was America absolutely able to impose its will on this very complex part of the world. And neither is America totally out of the picture today. America still has more troops than anyone else in the region, at more bases and more reach. America still has enormous amount of economic clout in the region. Whether or not that's used wisely or not, I don't know. I think, though, that what you've put your finger on is a very important point. America is no longer interested in defining the Gulf the way that Jimmy Carter did in 1979. It's no longer a central area of American interest. And when America says that, other people, whether or not America is still powerful and still there, other people react. I think what America hopes, once again, is that the Arabs will be able to police themselves. And the recent history of the last month and a half has indicated that this is not going to be easy.
But don't you afraid that the U.S. can lose its influence on this region when you talk about everything you said?
Well, it's not a question of losing its influence. That is to say, please don't see it as America calls the shots and then America stops calling the shots. America has always done certain things to put pressure on different countries or to try to induce different countries to do things to varying degrees of success, you know, from Henry Kissinger to Jimmy Carter to the Oslo Accords and Bill Clinton, all these kinds of things. There's been various ways of trying to influence. My question for my American colleagues will be, you have thought that you could use the phrase that Jake Sullivan used in the article, that, you know, this area is quiet and slowly moving towards a kind of stability. That doesn't seem to be true, does it? Therefore, will America use the power that it has? And it does have extraordinary power. Will it decide to use it to engage in a certain way, a way that maybe is different than in the past? We don't know that yet. I think America is still adjusting to the surprise of what happened, because the American intelligence, the Israeli intelligence, were absolutely clearly stunned by what happened on October 7th.
And with this open-ended answer, thanks, Ambassador, for your time. It was great having you. A lot of intel, a lot of information. Hopefully this will fly and the information will reach ears of also young people who are, many of them, demonstrating for Palestine and even for ISIS on European and American streets.
Let me add one last thing, if I could, which is that there is the tendency to want to make this into a black and white issue, and at the risk of being obvious, this will not be a black and white issue. It never has been, and it's not going to get any easier. Those people who wish to reduce it to you are with this side or you are with that side are only going to marginalize themselves, because it's going to be a very long and complex and very nasty situation.
Thanks for your time.
Great ending. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.